Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine, and I appreciate you listening in today. We're starting a little late, about 5:15, but we're going to go up until 6 o'clock. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I'm excited today to have with me Jack Lerner, a Samuelson Clinical Fellow at the School of Law at Bolt Hall, UC Berkeley. Jack's here today to discuss an issue that we've previously discussed with Professor Joanna Demers at USC involving the interesting issue of music sampling. And Jack is doing a kind of a cutting-edge study of sampling in the music industry, and so we're going to delve into his study and what that's all about, and also just talk generally about what sampling is and why it's something that you should be interested in, even if you're not a music fan. Obviously, many people listening to KZSU Stanford are music people and very interested in music, so this has a particular interest to them. But it's also really interesting from the standpoint of the intersection of intellectual property and innovation. And in the entertainment field especially, sampling has become one of those touchstone issues that kind of really moves you right into the center of where copyright begins and where it should end. So Jack is a great guy to have here to talk about this stuff, and I'm looking forward to chatting with him. By way of very brief introduction, Jack came to the Samuelson Clinic from the Berkman Center at Harvard, another outstanding organization that focuses on technology and law issues. And he is focused on online entertainment and other issues involving digital music distribution. Prior to going to Berkman, Jack practiced at the Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati right here in Palo Alto. And Jack is here live with us, and I appreciate him coming down here from Berkeley. So, Jack, are you there?
I am. Thank you, David.
Terrific. Thank you for coming down, making the trip down south into the South Bay and being here today. Jack, why don't we start off immediately with just kind of you defining and telling the listeners exactly what you mean by sampling.
Well, sampling essentially is, digital, anything that incorporates a snippet of sound from an early recording into a new musical sound recording is the working definition that I use and that a lot of people in the business might use. Another definition that I got from a sample clearance specialist is a little more complicated. A digital reproduction or replayed or resung reproduction of a specific sound or group of sounds taken from a pre-existing master recording or composition, which is used in a new recording. Bottom line, it means using something that's been used before in a musical recording. Now, sampling, the term, came from the actual tool that was used in the early 80s to take recordings from earlier records and put them into new recordings. And it actually is a technology of sampling, of actually taking a digital sample of something, and which means taking kind of a, making a digital approximation of an analog sound and then replaying that. And so sampling actually refers to a technology technically, but really it means a lot more in practical use. And this is important because now what you have, because of the particular law and the way the market works, and we'll get into this quite a bit, I'm sure, David, what you have now is a lot of people actually recreating samples with live instruments, recreating snippets of songs with live instruments to avoid having to deal with actually having copied someone else's actual, recording. So
it's sampling is one of those areas, and I just kind of want to get your a little bit of your normative sense of it. It's a very controversial area to a lot of people. They view it as we're going to talk about in a little while, but they view it sometimes as theft and not something creative. Before we get into your study, and I do want to talk about that, why is sampling something that's important? In other words, what are the arguments that go both ways when it comes to that? How would you sum it up?
Well, I can talk your ear off and,
yes,
and your listeners' ears off on that,
which is perfect on a talk show.
right. I guess that's what we're here to do. But sampling is indeed controversial. It's controversial for a number of reasons, cultural reasons. It's controversial because of the nature of the use. Sometimes it's controversial. It's really controversial for a lot of reasons. But it's interesting because reusing sounds goes back much further than rap music or hip hop music. Music, which is the first where the term sampling was first used, and where digital samplers from the early 80s and mid 80s actually were first used heavily. And, you know, if you can go back to jazz where people repeat riffs, you can go back to experimental electronic music and kind of avant-garde classical music that reuse sounds or reuse recording of sounds. And you can even go back to the classical composers who would often refer to each other with exact riffs that would go on and on. So it's interesting because sampling, if you think about it, and if you look at the history of music, as many people before us have done over the last 10 or 12 years, you see that sampling is actually not something that's particularly unique. Now, the way it's used now, where you actually have recordings that are recognizable, and you have snippets from popular music recordings, of course, has its own unique context. So, you can't equate that with riffs that no one even picked up on, besides the musicians themselves and that kind of stuff. So, it's certainly different. But another reason why it's not legitimized or isn't seen as legitimate by many sectors of the population is because it, hip hop music has a bad reputation in certain sectors. It has, you know, it's racism is one reason, but also because of some of the violence and stuff like that has come with it, and simply just lack of understanding on the part of a lot of people. And I think that's what's at the heart of. I think that's what's at the heart of why a lot of folks, whether it's in the record industry, and you've seen it with judges who have had sampling cases and all kinds of stuff, that's why a lot of folks don't necessarily think sampling is legitimate. Also, you have, let's just leave it at that. You know, some of the arguments for why sampling is more, for why is sampling is valuable. There's many arguments. I mean, okay, so let's talk about the cultural value of sampling. I mean, mm-hmm. Many DJing and the modern DJ culture, going back, whether you're talking about hip hop DJs or you're talking about club DJs or electronic music DJs or whatever you might call it, you know, involves songs that are all connected in a deep familial way. It's very self-referential. DJ culture and hip hop culture is very self-referential. The legitimate or more legitimized art forms of collage and pastiche are also very similar to sampling. So collage, if you look in the dictionary, is defined as a work like a literary piece that's composed of both borrowed and original materials and objects pasted over a surface, often with unifying lines and color. So that's a collage. A pastiche is a lighthearted, tongue-in-cheek imitation of another style. Mm-hmm. So that's right out of Webster's, but at the same time, you could call sampling that. You could call modern hip hop culture. You might describe it in terms similar to that. You know, the other thing is, one kind of influential commentator, David Sanyek, said that sampling is not so much ransacking the past as reanimating it. And another guy said hip hop is essentially ancestor worship. Hmm. So what you're talking about is people talking to each other in a self-referential way, or referring to each other, and it's a form of communication through music and cultural reference through music. Now, that's not to say that people who made a particular song and have that used in many other contexts shouldn't be compensated, and so you can get into the law and the policy of sampling and how that relates. But when you're just talking about the justifications, you know, there are a lot of justifications that go beyond they're just trying to free ride on somebody else's song.
Right, and it seems like it's off the topic of today's discussion, but it seems to me, in terms of those arguments, very similar to the debate right now around mashups, the online, which for those who aren't familiar, the reuse of songs synced with video or pictures that don't originally relate, but that create a new work. And one of the famous ones that brought a lot of attention to it was the Outkast "Hey Ya, Peanuts" cartoon. Uh-huh. And it's the same, I think, kind of argument and discussion that we could have, but not at this time. We'll move on. But really boils down to whether this is something new and whether really it's something creative. And it kind of leads me into my next question, which, in light of what you said about people's, especially in courts, use of sampling. What is the current legal status as you see it?
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about copyright. Copyright is the copyright statute establishes certain rights that are enumerated in the Copyright Act, and those rights are a limited set of rights. They include things like copying, distributing, publicly performing, and things like that. So when you're talking about popular music, you have two rights that are established by the Copyright Act, established by Congress, that provide exclusive rights to the author. And those rights are, one, you have the right to the sound recording. So that sometimes is also called the master. And the right to the sound recording is one of the rights that you need to clear when you want to clear a sample. In other words, when you want to get permission to use a sample. You also have what's sometimes called the publishing, sometimes called the composition right, and that's basically the person who composed the song. You generally need a license from that individual too, although that's somewhat controversial. So what are the rules in terms of sampling on when you need to get permission to use a sample that involves a recording and that involves the publishing? So the sound recording, basically, it's still not clear across the land, but one of the most major landmark cases on this came out in 2004 in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a federal court of appeals that covers, I think, Kentucky, Illinois, and Ohio. And that's the Bridgeport case. A lot of people have heard about that. And basically, the court said essentially that, you know, if you want to sample someone, then you need to get permission, no matter how tiny the recording. So that included that case was about a song off the album 100 Miles and Running by N.W.A. Dr. Dre sampled Funkadelic, and he sampled kind of a buzzing sound that was used in a Funkadelic song, and it actually was unrecognizable even by experts, I believe, but by the general public, both sides agreed it was unrecognizable. But the court said it doesn't matter. You actually used a digital recording of that song, and so you need to get a license or do not sample. And that's a direct quote. Get a license or do not sample. Yeah. So at least there, that's the law of the land, and that's essentially the practice of the land, too. If you use a sound recording, any sampling specialist and most lawyers will say you better get a recording of that even if it's unrecognizable. So that's why you have people like Kanye West, Dr. Dre, who actually go out and record copies of samples. So let's say you like a Funkadelic song. Let's say you like a song off of Cosmic Slop, for example. If you want to take a 2-second or a half-second snippet of that, unless you if you don't want to get a sound recording clearance, or at least get a sound recording license, then you need to go out and hire a band and there actually are specialists who will take an MP3 or anything you give them, and for $10,000 or whatever it is, they'll turn around and actually spend a week or 6 weeks or whatever it takes recording that, making a copy of that sound recording without actually copying it, so you don't have to get a license. Now, the publishing or the composition right is a little bit different. In that case, the leading case on that is one called Newton against Diamond, which was decided here in California. And Diamond is Michael Diamond of the Beastie Boys. Newton is James Newton, the noted jazz flutist. And what happened there is that the Beastie Boys on their Check Your Head album used a song, a really unique flute sound where you sort of blow into the flute and you hum while you're making the flute sound. And, you know, James Newton did this and it was great, but, you know, his album kind of didn't do much by the time 1992 or 3 came around when the Beastie Boys were using it in Check Your Head. So the Beastie Boys at that time paid $5,000, I think, for the sound recording sample so that they could use a copy. But they never got permission from James Newton. They got permission from his record company for the sound recording, but they didn't get permission from James Newton for the composition. So he sued, and they had a big trial, and the court said, you know, this is so small that it's what they call de minimis in the law, which means it's of the minimum. It's so little that, and such a small use that it didn't matter. And so the Beastie Boys won, and essentially what that means is if you use a tiny snippet of music, you don't necessarily need to get a composition right. Now, in practice, that's not how it works. In practice, everyone gets the composition license because they don't want to get sued. And so, you know, whenever you want to sample something, you can either just go out on a limb and risk it and risk that, you know, you don't get sued. And I'll talk a second about the consequences of doing that. Or you go out and get permission from the whoever owns the sound recording, which is usually a record company, and whoever owns the composition rights, which is sometimes a songwriter, sometimes a performer, sometimes, you know, they're one and the same. A lot of times they're it's owned half by the songwriter and half by a publishing company that the songwriter had contracted with. Sometimes there are co-writers, and sometimes there are more than two co-writers. And so in that case, you need to go around and get permission from every single person. And this can cost anywhere from just to hire a lawyer to do this. It can cost anywhere from $500 per clearance on up to, depending on how difficult it is and how well known your clearance person is. Mm-hmm. But this can, you know, it can turn out that you end up paying just lawyer fees. You end up paying a few thousand dollars just to get a sample. And then, of course, the fees for sampling widely differ. Some people just don't allow any sampling. So, for example, the guy who wrote most of the songs on Thriller, you know, I can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a guy named Rod Temperton who wrote most of the songs on Thriller, and he just doesn't like sampling, and so he doesn't allow any of his songs to be sampled. And so if you hear a Thriller sample, it's most likely underground or not cleared.
Right.
Now, if you know, a lot of times what happens is artists will get together with they'll sign a contract with the record company, and the record company will say, basically, you warrant that all your samples that you've used are cleared. You know, even though the record company might have hired the studio and the producer and the engineer and all that stuff, the artist is the one who warrants and basically guarantees that those samples are cleared. So if that's the case, and the artist says, well, you know what, I'm not going to tell them about these other 40 samples I've used, which happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem there is that when the record company gets sued, the artist, you know, has to pony up or ends up not getting paid. But, of course, at that point, you don't have any bargaining power, and essentially all of the profits from that song can be taken by the rights holder.
Right.
You know, one sampling clearance specialist that I talked to in the course of research for this project basically says to all of her prospective clients and all of her clients, if you don't tell me about a sample on this record and you get caught, congratulations, you have no bargaining power. So it's one of those things that's this is part of what our project's about, which is researching, trying to get a picture of the market for sampling out there in popular music. It's everything's behind closed doors. It's completely opaque.
It sounds that way, and we're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, I do want to get into, in the remaining time we have, what your project is about, music sampling, market, and reform. You're listening to KZSU Stanford and Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. We're going to take a short music break, which is somewhat apropos to our topic today, and when we return, I'll continue with Jack Lerner of Berkeley. Of course, that's the famous Run DMC and Aerosmith version of Walk This Way, which we'll return with Jack in a moment, kind of really hits into one of the most famous examples of the idea of sampling, if not actual sampling. But it really was probably the most famous and certainly one of the first fusions of the hip-hop and rock culture. Before we get back with Jack, I just want to ask you, as I always do on Hearsay Culture, if you like what you're hearing. And I hope that now you're applauding wildly. And I would ask you to make sure to help KZSU continue providing these great programs without commercials. I'm going to ask you straightforward to donate to KZSU. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And please continue to listen. So we're back here with Jack Lerner. And Jack, with that segue, the Run DMC segue, why don't you tell us overall, first of all, what the general thesis is of your project, Music Sampling, Market, and Reform?
Well, what we're doing at the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at Bolt Hall is trying to get a get a better picture of what the market looks like. Right now, the market is very opaque, and it's got high transaction costs. It's expensive to clear samples, but also it's a real hassle. It takes a long time. It's hard to track people down. You have to hire somebody to do it. You generally can't do it yourself. Sometimes you can't even get in, get people on the phone who are in a position to clear your samples. So we're trying to figure out, is there a way to, you know, first of all, shed more light on the market, but also can we build any structures, whether they're private or government structures, that would actually try to expedite the process, lower the transaction costs, and ensure that more samples get cleared and used, more samples get used, rather, and more artists get compensated for their samples that get used. And what we see now, some stuff going on underground, a lot of stuff going on behind closed doors, and simply a lot of samples not being done and a lot of samples not being cleared because they're just it's just too much hassle and it's too expensive. So what we've tried to do is talk to people in industry, try to get some idea about how processes work, and we've gotten a lot of great information about that, some of which I can share from you if there's time, but you're going to get bored quickly because it's all, you know, buyouts, advances against royalties, advances with rollovers, and that kind of stuff. But I can tell you this, it costs anywhere from $2,000 to $250,000 to clear a sample. We've learned that major...
A quarter of a million to clear a sample.
Yeah, you know, major labels generally, I've been told, won't sample anything for under $30,000. It's just not worth their while. If they don't expect to sell a lot of records, then it's really not worth policing. And so they just don't if someone thinks they'll sell a lot of records, they'll pay. And if they don't, then if someone wants to use a record label sample without getting permission, the record label reasons, okay, well, if they want to use that without getting our permission, that's fine, because if that record starts to sell a lot, then we'll just go after them and then we'll have more bargaining power. This is how some people view it, view the major's policy. So essentially they feel it's not worth their time to sample anything for under $30,000. Now, big acts like the Rolling Stone are going to be more like $300,000 or $250,000. And so when you're talking about a real major artist, it's really going to cost upwards of that. Most major hip-hop artists, the Kanye West, the 50s, Dr. Dre, for any given album, they're going to have a $50,000 to $100,000 budget for sample clearance. And sometimes that includes hiring these folks to actually reproduce exact copies of samples so that they don't have to pay the master. They just have to pay the composition, or maybe they choose not to. But generally, that can cost, you know, $10,000 or more. Mm. I've heard all kinds of different estimates about how many samples are not cleared, but I can tell you that it's a really significant amount, probably more than 25%. Mm. But unfortunately, that's not much more than wild guess, because the market is just so opaque. And, you know, the other major interesting data point here, or interesting aspect, is that it's generally unreproducible sounds from 1970s funk and big band music that are still the most sampled. Hmm. So you do get a lot of self-referential kind of stuff, like let's try to sample, you know, Madonna, or let's sample U2 or whoever. But generally that kind of stuff, first of all, is too expensive, and second of all, is easier to reproduce without clearing the sound recording sample, and so it doesn't get cleared. And what people really want to sample are those unreproducible sounds from 1970s funk made with older equipment, now obsolete equipment, and of course, big band music is hard to reproduce too. You know, and when it goes through the aging process of the medium and all that stuff, it gets hard to reproduce.
Jack, let me ask you, just stepping back for a second on the definition of sampling. Uh-huh. When the example that I used in a music break, the idea that Run-DMC would take a beat, take a portion of a song, in that case, again, they obviously worked with Aerosmith, and it's a little bit different than what you described. But I'm curious if you would say that something like Negative Land, the famous recordings where Negative Land took portions of Voice that Casey Kasem had erroneously apparently allowed to go on the air, or at least became public in some other way. They sampled his voice and used it in connection with other music to ultimately say something. I mean, whatever their point was, it was definitely an example of using someone else's potentially copyrighted materials in a way that obviously, I would imagine, would upset a lot of people, and obviously, in the case of Negative Land, it did. Is that part of what you're talking about with sampling, or is that something different?
Well, I would say yes, it is. I mean, there's many different types of sampling, and I'll just walk you through the four types that I've identified that I like to think of. Okay, so Run-DMC, Vanilla Ice using a David Bowie sample from the song Under Pressure.
Mm-hmm.
MC Hammer using Rick James for what was that song?
Yes, I know exactly.
Can't Touch This.
Yeah, right.
Puff Daddy lifting entire song. I mean, basically, you take another song and make that the recognizable backbone of your song. And Walk This Way is a good example of that. That's somewhat similar to a mashup, but different in other ways too. Because what you're doing is basically turning another song into a backbone of your beat. Then you can have kind of a sound quilt like Grandmaster Flash and the Wheels of Steel. I think the song is called Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, but it's a very famous song that's just essentially a quilt of different sounds strung together, and you know, everything from nursery rhymes. Beatles Revolution Number 9 is an example of that, and I would say Negative Land is too. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you have a huge amount of both familiar and arcane samples. David Sanyet calls this chaos theoretician. So that's Public Enemy, The Avalanches. That's where you take essentially so many samples that you make like a wall of sound that creates a, you know, building blocks for a song, but also just generally such a big amount. But you could also think of sampling as remixes.
Mm-hmm.
The general public, if you ask somebody what sampling is, they're going to say the use of somebody else's song as the backbone of a beat, or scratching to a particular sampled sound and using that in a more kind of directly referential context, as opposed to the sound quilt kind of thing, and kind of using it as a building block somehow. So I would say it is, but, you know, would the general public? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, I mean, when you're talking about the sampling market or sampling reform, really what you're talking about are those first that first type where you have the backbone of a beat or something repeated in a song that's mm-hmm. sampled from a recognizable other song.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a long, really long-winded and academic answer.
Yeah, well, no, but I think it's, you know, I think the reason I asked it is that I think you're right in what you just said, that I think most people, when they think about sampling, think of those hip-hop examples and what Public Enemy did and other groups, and it's at least not to me immediately apparent that what we're talking about is something potentially much broader, and that it has an impact beyond certain genres of music to potentially really get into parody and other areas that again, I think a lot of people, and I'm saying myself also, when mm-hmm. I initially thought about these things, wouldn't have considered to be sampling. You talk a little bit in your presentations about compulsory licenses versus mandatory licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another issue that comes up regularly in copyright whenever you're dealing with situations where an entity or a person is trying to control what they deem to be their property right in a particular creation. Give us a little bit of idea of, and I recognize that this is a topic that you could go on for quite a while, and we're limited, unfortunately, by the medium of radio and the medium of having schedules to not delve into as much as I'd like. But in a very kind of brief top-level way, compulsory versus mandatory licenses, how does this fit into the analysis that you're conducting at Berkeley?
Well, I would actually say compulsory licenses versus negotiated licenses.
Okay.
So right now what you have is what you might call a negotiated license regime, which is some term I just made up. But mm-hmm. the idea is if you want a license, you have to go out, find a person who's in a position to give it to you, and then negotiate with them and get it. A compulsory license is something there are compulsory licenses in the copyright law now, and a compulsory license is essentially when you have a rule that says you know, if I own the copyright to a particular work, I have to license that. I don't have a choice. I have to license it, and the person who licenses it from me doesn't have to get my permission, but they do have to pay me. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's done now. If you want to make what are called mechanical copies, which goes back to making physical copies, and it was done in a mechanical way. But anyway, so that's why you don't need to get permission essentially to cover a song now, because in Section 115 of the Copyright Act, for all you Stanford Law students who are listening, Section 115 actually says you can make a copy and you don't have to get a license for it. Now, in practice, the way that works, that particular type of thing is, that particular rule is, no one actually goes through the statute and does that. Instead, what they do is the statutory rate is about eight cents per song. That's the rate that you have to pay me if I don't want to give you a sample, but you want to get one anyway. So the 8 cents essentially works as a ceiling on the price of clearance for that type of, for just making a copy, if you want to put out a box set or whatever. So that's something that a lot of people have proposed for sampling. Let's make a compulsory license for sampling so you don't have holdouts. That makes the transaction cost lower, and that makes it and that makes everyone happy, right? Well, not exactly, because you have a lot of different types of samples, all right? So Puffy basically making a remake of a song is quite a bit different from, you know, from the Dr. Dre 100 Miles and Running sample that was at the heart of the Bridgeport case. That's not even recognizable. So how are you going to value these equally? It's not fair. And, you know, too many variables is what everybody in the industry says. And I happen to agree. There are too many variables. Mm-hmm. So what I've tried to think about and what we're thinking of proposing, kind of thinking about, is, well, let's have gradations, all right? So you have the Puffy almost remake, but you also have an unrecognizable sample. Maybe that should be free. If it's unrecognizable, then who cares, right? Well, there's also, you know, you could have basically different levels of you could say, okay, well, if they incorporate recognizable beats into a loop, if they just have a recognizable sound once, maybe that costs less. Or maybe it costs more. If they have a recognizable beat as pretty much the whole looped beat, like in the Run DMC song you played, maybe that would cost more. Mm-hmm. And so on. So you could have gradations. And a lot of people have proposed that over the last probably 15 years in like law review articles and stuff like that. But what you could really do is actually go out and talk to musicians, producers, and figure out exactly how that's done. Mm-hmm. And actually have gradations like that based on what's out in the industry. But I would say that's not all. You know, why don't we do it like this? Like, what's good economically about sampling? Well, one of the things that's good is you can revive artists' careers. So, you know, your Rufus I'm not going to go there, but
Wainwright. That's always a tough
right,
one.
Right, or he's actually, I'm getting mixed up here, but you know, there's a lot of artists whose careers have been revived by having something sampled. People say, that is a cool sample. I want to know who that artist is, and they actually increase sales of the song. The artist gets his or her career revived. So let's say, okay, well, if something has sold X number of records, let's say something has in its lifetime sold 2 million records. Well, that should cost more than the one that never sold more than 30,000 records. Mm-hmm. You know, let's have that one be cheaper and try to incentivize and get that artist some money and charge more for one that's, you know, that's been a big seller. Or let's say one is actually increasing in popularity. And so you can plot the trajectory of that song and you can tell it's on the rise. So maybe it's only sold 30,000, but it's selling quite a few. Mm-hmm. So that's going to cost more. And so we're going to use ones whose economic lives and whose cultural lives have petered out. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or you could say, we're just going to do older works. So let's just have older works from you know, if it's 30 years old, it's going to cost less than if it's 15 years old. I mean, mm-hmm. there's lots of ways you could do that. But the idea is, let's try to structure it in a way that incentivizes the kinds of uses that we like and that incentivizes more sampling clearance that happens faster, that happens with fewer transaction costs, and it's easier. And the thing is, you know, I don't understand why record labels aren't all over this and saying, all right, we've put together our catalog, we went around and talked to all of our artists, and we've figured out how much they want to charge for every song.
Mm-hmm.
Some don't want violence. Some do want don't care whether it's violence or not. In other words, don't care whether the sampling song is a violent song or, you know, misogynist or talks about drugs or whatever. I mean, some people have parameters, and they'll say, I'll sample it to anyone, but if they use violence in their lyrics or if they're misogynist or they talk about drugs, I won't sample it, period. And so, mm-hmm. you know, record companies could go out and proactively kind of figure those things out and then put out a catalog or put out some kind of publication and say, you know, just register online and go for it, you
right.
know, sign this contract that we've pre-done and go for it. So one way to possibly help this along is to form a sampling clearance organization, a sampling rights organization like BMI or ASCAP, which does something similar for performance rights.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, for when you have to go through BMI when you want to play something in your nightclub or whatever. So that's one strategy, you know, form a private organization to do kind of, you could say, an advanced clearance or whatever. Now, obviously, that's an expensive proposition, but, you know, maybe it would pay for itself with sampling fees, like you pay a fee to, you know, to clear your sample or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the ideas we're working on. We're talking to folks in the industry to get their reaction, and we're seeing if it's possible to do that. But essentially what you're seeing in today's landscape, in my view,
mm-hmm.
is people leaving a lot of money on the table. You're seeing artists and the record companies that own these artists' masters leaving a lot of money on the table, not getting compensated for samples, that they don't have the resources to go out and find people, the people who are using them, and
mm-hmm.
they're leaving money on the table, and it's a shame.
Yeah, that doesn't, and it certainly, to the extent that it impedes the creation of interesting music and new music, that's even another reason.
Absolutely.
For it. We're out of time, but I just want, the last question though is in terms of the final product, when can we look for Berkeley to put out one of their great reports? Is there an outside time or any time frame you're thinking of?
We're hoping to have something out by the end of the year, David.
Okay, great. Well, I look forward to seeing it, and I think it's a great project, and I want to thank Jack Lerner from Bolt Hall for coming down today. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you very much.
Terrific. We are coming up on the hour, and we're coming up on Brownie in Motion with your imaginary friend. And so I'm just going to close the show in the remaining few minutes to again thank Jack for being here and for discussing the work that he's doing and others are doing at Berkeley. I had Chris Hufnagel from Berkeley on a few weeks ago, and it was terrific to have him here as well. So I'm enjoying these conversations with my colleagues in the East Bay area. I'm looking forward to a number of interesting guests coming up, and just to preface where we're going to be going in the coming weeks, next week I'm planning on airing an interview with Professor Chris Sprigman, who is a professor of law at the University of Virginia and who's done an interesting study on copyright law in the fashion industry. I'm also looking forward to going into October and later October interviewing several authors, including Alastair Roberts at Syracuse, who's written a fascinating study of government secrecy in the technological age called Blacked Out, as well as Eric Davis, author of Technosis, and Eric von Hippel, who wrote a great book called Democratizing Innovation, and a number of other authors. So I'm going to be turning in the direction of talking to authors of works and delving into some of these areas that I think are fascinating. So I encourage you to listen to those shows, both live, hopefully, on KZSU, where you're listening right now. You can also find the show by podcast, going to iTunes. And I've said this for several weeks, but I will say that I am much closer to launching a website connected with the show, where you'll also be able to find the audio, as well as links to particular bits of information that are discussed in a given show. So I'm hoping to have that up relatively soon, and I'll be curious to get your thoughts and comments on it. So you're listening to KZSU Stanford. My name is Dave Levine, a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. I was here today with Jack Lerner of UC Berkeley and their Samuelson Clinic. And thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Brownie in Motion and Your Imaginary Friend, and I will talk to you by recording next week.